to call in, but you'll have to call in on the number. Okay, so we're back on. And are you there, Brendan?
Yep.
Okay, great.
Are you there?
So, yeah. Okay.
By the way,
I don't know
Meryl,
what happened. We got disconnected, but so it is.
Hezzy,
so we're back on.
Hezzy.
Yes.
Hezzy. Marilyn told me
yes?
we've been on air for 15 minutes.
Oh, you're kidding me.
No.
All right. Well, I hope we haven't offended anybody.
I've offended a lot of people. It's okay. Don't worry about it. What else?
How you doing, Jeff?
Just, you know, it's just part of today. What can I tell you? I'm okay. For people that are wondering why everybody's asking how I am, I have COVID. Marilyn has COVID. This is the only one place that we went together was to the Tropicana to watch the Yankees beat up on the Rays. And unfortunately, probably picked it up there somewhere with the people that were around us from New York. So it's
those
one of
New
those
Yorkers,
wonderful days. Yeah, I'm telling you, Hezzy, you and your New Yorkers, I'm telling you. I don't know what I'm going to do with you people. Okay, we didn't get
I
to say hello
myself.
To my girlfriend. Well, we didn't get to say hello to my our master of ceremonies as she made the countdown and said, Blog Talk Radio. And I really miss it, so she'll have to do it twice next week.
Okay.
I'm Jeffrey Swartz. I am a professor of law at Thomas M. Cooley Law School. Well, that's not Thomas M. Cooley Law School anymore. It's WMU Cooley Law School. And I'm here with my compatriot, Brendan Beery, who is also a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School at the Tampa Bay campus. And what we're about to say and the opinions that we render and the terrible things we say about people are our opinion and our opinion only, and not necessarily the opinion of the administration and or faculty of WMU Cooley Law School. It's faculty either at large or individually. And here's my very busy compatriot, Brendan Beery, who's just like all over the television and all over the radio and all over the print media.
Yes.
Couldn't be prouder of him. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeff. Hey, the last time, didn't I talk to you yesterday?
Yeah.
And you didn't have symptoms at that point. So when did that start?
Came on last night.
This morning.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
And it got worse this morning.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, got the classics. I got the stuffy nose and the headache mm-hmm. and the fever and the cough and the sneezing and all the stuff that goes
yeah.
with it. So that's, you know, where I am right now. And I'm waiting
yeah.
to hear from my doctor, who probably is going to do nothing until she gets me into her office for an office visit, because God forbid she should put in a prescription and not get paid for an office visit.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so I'm going to say, you really want somebody with COVID walking in your office just to get a prescription from you? Seriously?
Mm-hmm.
This is what you want? Okay. you know, and I'm going to say, is the doctor actually going to be there? Because I haven't seen her the last five visits I've been there. I get the physician's assistant. I think she
yeah,
works like
right.
one day a week just to come in and count the money. So,
so you're
she
a big fan
she
of
about
medical
it.
Practice. All right.
Right, and I'm not using a name because, you know, somebody might hear it, and then she says, go find yourself another doctor in the middle of my head
yeah,
on
right.
COVID.
Right.
Because she's so concerned about the patients, not the money. So, you know, that's all I can tell you. Brendan's been a very busy boy the last few days, talking to the press. You know, he's really getting the hang of this.
Brendan's
you're doing
good,
man. Brandon, he's doing good there, you know? I got to tell you. Proud of him.
I tell you what, I'd rather not be, so. But,
yeah.
Whatever.
Well, for what you're talking
but
about,
you're so
I can
clear.
Understand that.
The clarity yeah. and succinctness of your mind and your thinking
there
it matters.
There it is.
I'm blushing.
There it is.
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
it's okay, but we can't see that.
You're soaking it all in. Don't give me
right.
that. Okay.
Right. Let's move on
okay.
to another subject. I don't like talking about me. Let's there's
oh,
plenty else
let's
to
talk
about
you for a while because I like embarrassing you. Okay. Okay. There's so much to talk about, and there are so many things happening that we've got to kind of keep it short on some of the things that we are going to talk about. But I'm going to start out very quickly with an interesting article that I found from the Daily Beast by someone by the name of Erin Gloria Ryan. And she basically says, are Joe Manchin and Susan Collins stupid, or do they just think we are?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? Are they stupid, or do they think we are? And I think that it's – yeah, I think they think we are. Of course, you know, look at the states they're from, Maine and West Virginia. These two have always identified themselves as pro-choice senators, and they voted to confirm Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, basically claiming that they were told by these two that they would never overturn Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
I doubt seriously that Brett Kavanaugh, who has read Neil Gorsuch's book, ever said to them that he would never overturn Roe v. Wade. That's not what he said in his testimony. That's not what Gorsuch said. Gorsuch danced around it, pointed to his own book, kept claiming it's precedent on precedent. But what he didn't say was what Mother Superior Amy said in her testimony when she said basically that what we're dealing with here is a precedent that she considered to be not a super precedent and that she thought was egregiously and wrongfully decided. Now, she never said that at her hearings, but she had said it enough in her writings that that should have been no secret. These two danced around. Well, it's precedent on precedent. It's settled law. It's settled law until it's not settled law. Wake up, Manchin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Come out of the coal mine that you own. Come off of your boat occasionally that's parked in the Potomac where you live and start recognizing that you're supposed to be a smart guy. Now, I'm not saying that about Susan Collins. I don't think she's a smart guy or a smart woman. But I think she lies. She has always tried to paint herself as being in the middle, but push comes to shove, she always votes with the Republicans. Always votes with the Republicans, unless her vote doesn't count. It doesn't matter. And then she votes with the other side because they were going to win anyway. That's been her history. I mean, these people were recommended by the Federalist Society and put on a list by the Federalist Society. What did you expect them to do? I got fooled as regards Gorsuch. I sat with Harris Hawks a few years ago at a New Year's Eve weekend kind of get-together called Renaissance Weekends. We were on a panel together. We talked more than once, trying to convince me that Gorsuch's book tells you what he's like, he's never going to overturn it. And the interesting part is we talked about a case called Dickerson, United States versus Dickerson, in which the government objected to the use of a statute that was intended to overturn Miranda, which is probably going to be, that case is probably going to be reconsidered very shortly.
Mm.
But he said, yeah, he thinks that way too. You know, Miranda was around for 45 years and we needed, you know, we needed Miranda and it's precedent upon precedent upon precedent. They'll never overturn it. Yet there are those on this court who will sit here and say, and he better be careful here, that are going to say it was egregiously decided in the first place, that it was procedural due process and as a result of which it was wrongfully decided. And so we're going to go back to voluntariness as the only issue. Okay, even if they did drop phone books on your head. So this is what we're looking at. And this is the kind of people that we're looking at. So Manchin and Collins have no one to blame on all of these things but themselves. Because
if you don't mind,
go
ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is that if it was up to Kamala Harris, these two would not have been on the Supreme Court. End of story. And anybody that came off of that list from the Heritage Foundation would never, ever, ever see the light of day. I can't feel sorry for them. I don't want to hear them. The writer of this article ends it rather succinctly. She says, there's bullshit. And then there's effing bullshit. And this is effing bullshit. And that's what it is. Effing bullshit. And that's what I think.
Before we continue, if you don't mind, there are two calls on the line that are probably for you. So I wanted you to finish. Did you want to say something?
Okay.
Did you want to say something, Brendan, before we take our first callers?
No, go ahead.
Yeah. All right. So let's take them in order as they came in and ask each one of them to individually. We'll ask the first one that called in their first name so we can respectfully address them. So good morning. Can you hear me? Or maybe you're just listening in. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Oh, hi. My name is John.
Hi, John.
Good morning.
Yeah, I was just wondering, you know, what your stance was on shoving a whole baseball in your ass, if you had any thoughts on that.
Only if I could shove it in yours. Disconnect him.
Oh, okay. You can shove it in mine.
Absolutely.
Disconnect him.
That's okay. It's amazing. I know where these people come from. You know, there's no intellect here, but we never know. All right.
I thought that was a good answer.
Right.
Did you think that was a good answer?
That was a good answer. Yeah.
Very intellectual caller. I really appreciate that.
Intellectual answer. I can do better than that, but that was the quickest I could come up with in my physical condition today.
No, you're good. You were faster than my finger. Anyway, so let's get the next caller and see what's on their mind. Good morning. Thanks for waiting. Would you be kind to give us your first name? Okay.
No, I think that's Marilyn.
In?
No, I think that's Marilyn.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, we'll leave her on. Okay.
Thank you.
So no problem. No, thank
you. Good morning, Marilyn.
All right.
Okay. Everybody say good morning to Marilyn.
Good morning, Marilyn. How are you?
Hope you're feeling okay.
She's going to be 70.
Oh, my God. She's
young. She really enjoyed being at the baseball game because one woman that was sitting near us leaned over and she says, you're just so beautiful. And I leaned over and I said, yeah, and she's 70 years old. I'm not a dirty old man. And they started laughing. Listen, dirty old men need love, too. Okay, go ahead, Brendan. You're up.
Well, now I'm afraid to say anything. I don't want John to call back.
Exactly.
Well, maybe he'll talk about
it. Tell me what he wants to shove
for
up
you.
My rear end. Yeah.
No, he's going to talk about a basketball for you. But go ahead.
Yeah, right. Right. So, you know. And what I'm about to say is not going to reach John's level of poetry, but
the depths of
at any rate,
poetry.
Yeah. You know, that was kind of fun. We need more callers like that, you know.
Yeah, we really do. You just have to be quicker with the button, Hezzy.
Yes, I'm going
when
to
When I give
there,
a retort, that means hit the button. If I say something like that, Hezzy, you got to hit the button right away. Okay.
Okay.
God. All right. Well, here's what I want to talk about this morning, because there are a number of different cases that have come down from SCOTUS. It's not just abortion. Obviously, that's gotten the most attention. There's also a gun case Second Amendment case where the Supreme Court struck down a New York restriction on concealed carry. And there are two religion cases. The most recent one was the praying coach, who intoned sectarian prayers at the 50-yard line after every game. And then there's the abortion issue as well. So there's a common thread running through these decisions, and people really need to be aware of what this is. There's been a decades-long debate, and this goes to the Federalist Society, Heritage Foundation, and whatnot, about two competing theories of how to interpret the Constitution. One theory is called originalism, and under this approach, the Constitution is not an evolving document. It is fixed. Fixed in time, and also fixed to a kind of a superficial type of meaning. And the two key dates in terms of constitutional interpretation and rights are 1791, because that's the year the Bill of Rights was ratified, and 1868, because that's the year the 14th Amendment was ratified. And the 14th Amendment is the one that restricts what states can do to citizens or to the people within their jurisdiction. So this is obviously the right-wing preference, right, is that we hew very closely to these dates. What you'll notice when you read through these cases is the constant reference to 1791 and 1868. In the gun case, the court said the New York's restriction was unconstitutional because there were not restrictions like it in 1791 or 1868. In the religion cases, the court said when it comes to government violations of free exercise, the relevant inquiry is historical, right? And to look to our history and tradition. If something has been historically, traditionally accepted, and again, we're going all the way back, right, 1791 and 1868, then it's still acceptable now. So that's the new religion test. It's nothing but history and tradition. When it comes to abortion, Justice Alito made clear the court's view on what is a constitutionally protected right. One must concede, of course, that the Constitution says nothing about abortion. What the Constitution does presume in both due process clauses is that we have liberty. So that's a very broad term. The question, up until now hasn't been, does the Constitution mention the word abortion? The Constitution, the question up until now has been, when the Constitution presumes that we have liberty, that we're entitled to that, which that's not too difficult to define. That means you live in a free country, a free society. Does that include things like a woman's choice, right? What to do about her pregnancy, right? I mean, so is that part of being in a free society that the state doesn't make that decision, but the woman does? And that goes to, same-sex marriage and, your ability to raise your own kids, your decision who to marry in traditional marriage. I mean, all these questions, contraception, can the state stop you from using contraception? All of these things have been analyzed as components of liberty, especially given that the Ninth Amendment, this is really important, the Ninth Amendment explicitly says that the listing of certain rights in the Bill of Rights cannot be used to deny other rights retained by the people. The competing view of how to interpret the Constitution, the competing view to originalism, is living constitutionalism. Here's the point I want to make. The framers of the Constitution intended for it to be a long-term deal, to last for generations. Now, there was actually debate about that. Thomas Jefferson, I can't remember the exact, I think he said every 18 or 19 years, the Constitution should simply expire, right, and the next generation should write its own. But he lost that debate. The founder said, no, we're going to draft a long-term, right, something that will endure. Key properties, people have studied this. Key properties of constitutions internationally, right, and historically that have endured for a long time have been malleability. And so malleable, mm-hmm. you know, if you think about metal, right, metal is malleable if it bends under stress. And so constitutions have to do that too, right? A constitution has to react without breaking to shocks, right? World wars, Great Depression, terrorist attacks, insurrections, right? I mean, you know, history was not, you know, that the founders did not purport to be prophets and know what history was, how it was going to unfold. So that's one property it requires. A related point is it requires ductility for a constitution to endure. And ductile is different than malleable. Ductile means you can stretch it without it separating, mm-hmm. Like a rubber band, right, that has a ductility. And that relates to time, right? If a constitution's meaning cannot evolve with the culture and social norms of a society, then it snaps. It breaks. It's not workable anymore. Right? It's brittle. And that's the danger we're in here, is that we have a court that is interpreting the Constitution in a way that it has no properties of malleability or ductility. It has stuck us to 1791 and 1868, a time when women couldn't vote, times when women couldn't hold property in their own names, right? For much of that history, slavery existed in much of the United States. And so can the Constitution endure under an interpretive methodology that fixes it to a point in time and to superficial understanding? And that's the question that we have. What I really think this morning is we got a big, big picture problem here. It's not just about abortion. It's not just about the Second Amendment. It's not just about the religion clauses. It's about a court that, unlike previous courts, has completely removed these properties of I'll say it, flexibility, right, and evolving meaning. Why would the founders use terms like liberty instead of a bill of particulars? Why did the drafters of the 14th Amendment use general terms like equal protection and due process? Why did they write in these general terms? Well, because those words are flexible. What liberty means can change. What processes do can evolve. We can gain understanding about that. Equality, right? We can evolve as a society and say, yeah, you know what? We've learned more about sexual orientation. We probably shouldn't be targeting people based on that. Right, that's not that these people are entitled to equal protection. We didn't used to think that, but you know, now we get it. But if you don't want any of that, and that's what this is really about, right? You don't want gay people to have rights. You don't want women to be able to make this choice. If this is just stuff you don't want, then we've got to go back. And that's where we're at. So I'm sorry for that long
dissertation.
Okay. Yeah, but
brilliant.
I would only add on to this is that what they're talking about and what is contained within the concurring opinion of Justice Thomas, one, you have to recognize that Justice Thomas has been working for this end. He followed Justice Scalia down this road for 25 years. 30 years. He wants to get us to the point where we're back in the 1850s. And that's what he wants. So when he talks about some of these things, the one thing that nobody really actually is talking about, or some people allude to it because they don't want to get it racially involved, they don't talk about the Loving case from Virginia, because I think that Justice Thomas has, for the greater part of his career, lived off of the interpretations of the Supreme Court and the movement towards equality and all the things that go with it that came out of the court to further his own nest, to get what he wanted. And now that he has what he wants, he's ready to go back. Because I got what I want. I got mine. Nobody else. I don't want anybody else to get what I got. He is jealous of the legacy of Thurgood Marshall. He is jealous of those who have left the court and been enshrined in the minds of people. He has found people that will enshrine him for two reasons. One, they like what he says, but the second reason is they want to look like they're colorblind in their attitudes. And he wants to take advantage of it. So he's against affirmative action, even though that's how he got to where he is. And I know he's saying, I got these grades and I got that grades and I got in on my merit. No, you didn't. And you're a Supreme Court justice simply because you are, as much as this will surprise you, you're black. They had to find a black conservative, and there was your wife standing there pushing you upon Bush 1. We have a conservative black judge. He's only been on the court for about 9 months, but he'll be fine. Been on the circuit, you know, for 9 months, not realizing what his real background was. And I honestly believe that he literally doesn't care about the Constitution. He only cares about himself. I read an article. I don't vouch for its total accuracy, but I read an article that apparently is quoted Forbes, and I have not been able to find a Forbes article that says this, so I have to take this with a grain of salt, that his wife, Jenny Thomas's net worth is $78 million. She owns, I think it was four or five houses, one of them a multi-million-dollar house out in California. Supposedly she owns 9 luxury cars, 3 boats. He lives a pretty good life for a guy who's only making a couple $100,000 a year. Better than he ever would as a professor. So I think all he cares about is his money, and his rulings are all about his money, and it's all about protecting his wife and getting her more people. I mean, let's face it, that's what it's all about for him, and I've said this a number of times, and I will continue to say it. It's not coincidental that her organizations took off and people hired her after her husband got on the Supreme Court. I'm sorry, don't believe in coincidence. So this is where we are. This is where we are. A guy who's leading a charge to line his own pocket. But he denies he knows anything about his wife's business. Honey, you just bought a new Rolls Royce. Yeah. Where'd you get the money? Don't talk to me about that. You don't want to know. Really? That's what happens? Let's go out to California for the weekend on our Malibu beach house with 4 bedrooms. Where'd we get that? Don't ask. I'm sorry, I'm not buying it. and I never will. So there's something very unseemly. So that's my reaction to what you had to say. I mean, he wants to tear apart everything. And when he tells you he wants to do this, believe him. And he has the ability to do it. And then he'll go after Miranda. And then he'll go after Terry. And who knows? He may even set aside Brown versus Board of Education, saying Plessy versus Ferguson is fine with him. I got mine. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Like I didn't. So I have real problems with this guy, but he's telling you he's going after everything. But he won't go after the Loving case because, yeah, that's about him. People don't really want to talk about that in terms of him because they don't want to sound racist. I'm not racist. I don't think Loving should be touched in any way, shape, or form. You don't know, you know, you love who you love. You marry who you want to marry. So be that as it may. I want to talk about RBG and how something that she said back in 2013 is being taken out of context. She did a 90-minute interview at the University of Chicago Law School back in 2013. And it was basically brought about because Roe versus Wade was at 40 years old. And she said the following, and I'm quoting, "My criticism of Roe is that it seemed to have stopped the momentum on the side of change." She said she would have preferred that abortion rights be secured more gradually in a process that included state legislatures and the courts. Ginsburg was also troubled that the focus on Roe was on a right to privacy rather than women's rights. And here's a very telling thing. Roe isn't really about the woman's choice, is it? It's about the doctor's freedom to practice. It wasn't woman-centered. It was physician-centered. And that is accurate. Roe v. Wade was about the ability of a doctor to perform an abortion because none of the laws that were anti-abortion were designed to punish the woman, only the doctor or the person performing the abortion. So she was upset that it was centered about the right of privacy as opposed to the freedom of the doctor to practice medicine. It wasn't centered around women. But women took what they could get, and you can't blame them. Someone found a way to apply the 14th Amendment properly and did it based upon the right of privacy. In her back and forth with one of the people that was on the panel, who happened to be a man who was Justice William Brennan's clerk in Frontiero and Roe, two leading cases in this area, she offered many fascinating observations. She talked about what life was like for women in the not-so-good old days, when judges believed that the laws restricting women from certain work, such as bartending or lawyering, were there to protect the fairer sex. Her goal as a litigator was to show judges that these rules marginalized women rather than protect them from harm. She said the only well-heeled girls and women who found themselves, it was only well-heeled girls and women who found themselves with an unwanted pregnancy had the option to get an abortion by traveling abroad, while poorer women had no such option. For most young women, the only way to deal with it was to marry him. That was why she wanted to decide it differently. that women have, as has been argued over and over again, the right to control their own bodies, their own destiny, and their own lives, just like men do. That was her lifetime goal, was to get equality for women. I think she realized that Roe was difficult and could lead to some terrible things happening. I think she knew it. So my question to her in the grave is, that was 2013. If you knew that was a possibility, why did you hold on instead of letting Obama replace you? I don't understand. This is a woman who thought three-dimensionally and straight ahead for years. A brilliant mind. When she had this little tete-a-tete in Chicago, she was over 80 years old. She should have made the decision right there and right then, and then gone out and spoken out as a former justice and rallied the troops. But she didn't do that. But she's being misquoted. People are saying she was against Roe. She wasn't against Roe. She just wished it had been decided in a different way. That's all. But now that the 14th Amendment is under assault, both in the criminal side and the civil side, we are at war. The war that I told both of you was coming. I said we were going to have a civil war, a legislative civil war, and it has started. The idea that they could bring in doctors from Illinois back to Arkansas and put them on trial because an Arkansan, a woman from Arkansas, went to Illinois and got herself an abortion, and now they're saying, wait a minute, you violated Arkansas law because people from Arkansas aren't entitled to an abortion. This is all happening. They're already talking about it. Christine Noem from South Dakota said, I don't want women to go to jail. I'm going after the doctors. I'm going after the abortionists. This is happening before your very eyes. This is the 1850s. And it's just, It's such a step backwards. It's like, watch out for that first step because it's a big one. It's like the dam has busted and now the water's starting to leak out and there's no way to put your thumb in the dike. Not with this court, who I refer to as either a papist court or an insurrectionist court. And I think the language of this opinion involving this guy who was kneeling at midfield, he couldn't do it on the sidelines. He couldn't do it in privacy. He had to make a spectacle of himself. I have a right to make a spectacle of myself. And the papists say, yeah, that's okay. Even if it does intimidate your players to join you or they don't get playing time. And he's going back. He's been living in Texas. He's going back now. He wants his job back. And at least according to the judgment, he's entitled to it. He was wrongfully fired. So these are the people that are making decisions for us. They are trying to establish the Catholic religion as the religion of this country by way of claiming certain constitutional judgments that are really more biblical judgments. How many of you believe out there that if a Muslim judge, a black Muslim judge, after a victory, goes out to midfield and starts praying to Allah on his carpet, that this court would have decided the same way. I'm not hearing either of you saying they would have. Of course they wouldn't have. But because he's a Christian, it's okay. I'm sorry. That's just not right. In front of his players, he's supposed to go out there with him. And he makes a show of himself. He makes a spectacle of himself in front of a high school stadium. Does he believe that Colin Kaepernick had the right to take a knee? Probably not. Kaepernick did it on the sidelines. He didn't go out to midfield and take a knee while they were playing the national anthem, did he? There's something very wrong here. And for whatever it is, Americans don't seem to care. That everything they learned during their entire lives is being taken away from them, and they don't care. Because they got their paycheck, they got their pickup truck, and they got their shotgun in the window. That's all I care about. And getting to go to Applebee's on a Friday night with the family. Because on Friday night, the kosher deli's closed. My diatribe, jump in. I've been talking for 10 minutes.
I'll just add what, in the praying coach case. First of all, we've reached the point of absurdity in terms of not being able to cope with facts. I talk about this a lot. We are entitled to, we need to distinguish between opinion and fact. But what is what is. And one of the problems we have as a country now is that we treat facts as opinions, or as said once, alternative facts, right? So we've got the facts and then we have alternative facts. There was a time in this country when we could agree on what had happened, right? We could agree, we could look out the window and say, yep, that's a tree. Now we look out the window and say, well, that's a bush. No, that's a tree. No, that's an airplane. I mean, we can't even agree on that. And this is now infecting the Supreme Court. And what I mean by this, in this opinion, is that Neil Gorsuch, for the majority, characterized what this coach did as a private prayer, right? A quiet, private prayer, which prompted the dissenting justices, led by Sotomayor, to actually put photographs. This was pretty remarkable. They actually put photographs in their dissent, saying the majority has called this a quiet, private prayer. So they put pictures of this coach at the 50-yard line, surrounded by players, surrounded by media, surrounded by parents, big crowd with the coach in the center, right, intoning a sectarian prayer, and all of his players around him, because who's not going to participate in that? This is a quiet, private prayer. Okay. See what I'm saying? I'm sorry. So now we can't even agree on. Never mind not agreeing on the law.
He's making a spectacle of himself.
Yeah, but it's a fact. That is not an opinion. That he was on the 50-yard line, surrounded by people, making a spectacle of himself. That is not an opinion. It's a fact. And Gorsuch couldn't even admit that. So that's the problem. Now, the other thing about this case, as long as we're overruling precedents that have been around for decades, in an utterly offhanded way, The majority of the courts cited two cases, Lemon. I'll explain what these are in a minute. Lemon case, every lawyer knows what Lemon is. And another case called Allegheny County, which was a big case in Establishment Clause cases. It offhandedly mentioned both of those cases and then announced, we long ago abandoned those cases. So it might as well have just said, those cases are now overruled. So what are these cases? What did they just do? Let me put it to you in terms of the curriculum that I now have to remake. They wiped out two-thirds, right? There are three big tests in Establishment Clause cases. By getting rid of Lemon and Allegheny County, the court, with the wave of a hand, with nary even a mention of reasoning, just said the two of those three are overruled. The Lemon case stands for the proposition that the government should not entangle itself with religion, among other things. But entanglement is one of the big words there. You can get to a point where the government, and certainly a public school is run by the government, is so tangled up with religion, whether it's money or whether it's religious practices, whatever the case may be, where it's going to start getting to the point where the government is really establishing religion. If there's excessive entanglement, that's gone. The Allegheny County case was a case about a nativity scene in a courthouse, centrally located, surrounded by nothing else, and whether that violates the Establishment Clause because it promotes a religious belief. And in that case, the court said, if the government appears to endorse religion, that's an Establishment Clause violation. So those two tests, entanglement and endorsement, were big parts, of a three-part analysis under the Establishment Clause. The third, incidentally, is coercion of students in public schools to say or behave in a religious, to speak or behave in religious ways. I'll talk more about that in a second. But I want to point out first, they overruled two cases. They announced the overruling of two cases of a three-case paradigm. So they are on a tear in terms of overruling precedent. They don't care one bit about decades worth of development of law in these areas. And as to coercion, they did pay lip service to that, but that's why Gorsuch said, well, this wasn't coercive because it was private, quiet private prayer. So therefore, nobody was coerced. Anybody who believes that can't discern what they see in picture. A lot going on there. I forgot to mention this at the beginning. I told Jeff I got to leave at around 5 to 11, so I've got about 5 more minutes, okay. And then I can.
Let me bring up something that's happening today. We got notice yesterday of an emergency, not emergency, but a hearing that was set for today for the 1-6 committee. It should be noted that every single member of the 1-6 committee was back in their districts, whether it was California or Wyoming or down south, I think Mississippi. It didn't matter. They all had to get on a plane yesterday and come back. And apparently it was unanimous. They all agreed that they needed to come back. It's projected that the person who's coming in is the chief assistant, last name of Hutchinson.
Mm-hmm.
She is apparently, we saw her at the last hearing talking about who asked for pardons.
Mm-hmm.
She was not under oath during that conversation. She had a lawyer who said, no, she won't go under oath, but she'll be interviewed. And a lawyer who said, no, she will not appear before the committee. Apparently she changed lawyers either last week or yesterday. And a phone call was made saying she's ready to go under oath. She's fed up with being accused of lying. And I think she's going to tell us that she's being threatened. And once she testifies, the threats go nowhere. I think they were told, you got to come back, you got to do her now, or she's going to change her mind again. I think that's what we're going to hear, that she's being threatened. and not by people who are crazies or founder or emails. I think she's going to say that she has heard from people connected to the president or to Meadows or to other people involved in 1-6 are being threatened not to testify, not to hand over everything she knows about what happened in the White House on 1-6. Now, it could be that she's not the big surprise. It could be that she's the cover for whoever the real surprise is. Because they keep promising there's new information, stuff that they think is important. Now, what I think is that the 1-6 committee has to get back in the news cycle. They're being drowned by the Supreme Court. People are losing interest in what they're doing because they're concentrating on what the Supreme Court's doing. So I think they felt they could not wait 3 or 4 weeks for another hearing. They had to do one now before July 4th, and there will be another one right after July 4th. They have to stay in the news cycle. That's my personal feeling. I'm sure what we're going to hear is going to be important. I'm sure what we're going to hear may be some new stuff that we haven't heard before, but I'm just not sure there's a big surprise. There could be. I could be all wrong. But I think this is just realizing they need to get back in the news cycle. No one's talking about them right now. Now they are. So I could be wrong. What do you think, Brendan?
Yeah, but they're going to have to produce some kind of testimony because now expectations are sky high. But they've been pretty good about that, of managing expectations.
Oh, yeah.
And I certainly agree. They have to break back into the news cycle. You know, as I always say, we have the collective
right.
attention span of a goldfish.
No, I think more like a gnat. Okay,
yeah.
I think a goldfish is a pretty smart fish. Okay,
no,
okay. They have an attention span. I don't know about that. They know what they want. They want food. Okay, yeah, they go right for the food. That's a pretty good attention
mm-hmm.
span, I think.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But yeah, a gnat, on the other hand, are no-see-ems if you ever walk through them before. Okay, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know where they're going. Got the foggiest freaking idea what they're doing. Okay, so I'll go with that one. But yeah, the American public has no attention span, and so they need to get back in to the news cycle before the July 4th weekend. And I think that's what this is more about. The last thing I want to talk about is the fact that John Eastman decided he wanted to have lunch in Taos, New Mexico. Wrong place to go. FBI was waiting for him. He should have changed his plans. Gone someplace else. But apparently that didn't work because they found him. And they took his phone on the same day that they raided Clark. Now this subpoena or this search warrant was issued in furtherance of an investigation by the Inspector General of the Justice Department because Eastman was not Eastman. I mean Clark. He is being investigated for the things that he was doing as part of the Justice Department. But if they just happen to, you know, look at his phone and find other calls, well, it's plain view. So it's okay. We'll just take whatever we can find. I don't think it has anything to do with these two guys. It could, but I don't think it does. I'm just not sure where they're going with this. But we'll find out when Ms. Hutchinson takes the stand and testifies today.
Mm-hmm.
She might have
That's
something new that she's never disclosed before.
Yep, get your popcorn.
I don't know. Well, I'm not eating any popcorn today. Sick as I am, I'm not eating popcorn.
Yeah.
I'll be sitting.
Well,
I have all the reasons. Yeah, you have to go. I know.
I have to take my life. I do have one suggestion before I go, though.
What's that?
I think every week we should award one of us. The John's Baseball Where the Sun Don't Shine Award. That's something we need to start a tradition. See who earned it. Who earned it that week?
Well, actually, I really feel bad that I didn't use the basketball line on him. I said, that would be fine if I can use a basketball on you. But, you know.
All right. All right. On that note, gentlemen, I got to go. But we'll see you next week.
I know you do.
Thank you. Have a good day.
I'll talk to you next week. Have a good week.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Okay. So what else you want to talk about? I got 3 more minutes here. Unless you want to get rid of me.
No, I don't want to get rid of you, but I just want to make sure you take care of yourself. That's all that matters. Because you got to be ready.
I do. I'll close this with the funny part of being sick.
Okay.
I call my doctor. Okay, doctor, I'm sick. Doctor, help me. And the doctor says, "Well, what's wrong with you?" "Well, I think I have COVID. I have a positive test, and I've got all the symptoms. I'd like to get the med. I need the medicine. Can you give me the medicine?" "I don't know. I'll have to talk to the doctor because I'm just the nurse." And I'm waiting for the phone call that says, listen, Mr. Schwartz, I got to tell you something. I'm not going to give you a prescription unless you come in here and I have a chance to see you to make sure you're really sick." "Did you really want someone with COVID walking into your office?" "Yeah."
"Yeah," she said, "yeah."
I think she's going to say, "Yeah." Okay. I just, you know, I'm sitting here saying, you know, give me the antiviral. I got a big weekend this weekend. It's Marilyn's birthday. We're having parties for her all weekend. She's very upset. She has COVID too. But she's on the medicine. What? She's got the medicine. I can't get the medicine. So it's sort of like the wedding. I'm paying all the bills, but I don't get to eat any of the food.
Well, the only thing that's important is that she has a happy birthday and that you get better.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
And then we'll see next time around.
All right. She deserves everything she gave me for my 70th and more. How's that?
All right.
So there you go. Okay, Hezzy, have yourself a great weekend.
You
next
too.
Time we'll try
All
to get
best.
On at 10 o'clock instead of 9:45. How's that sound?
Okay, that's a given. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
All right,
you
man. Have a great weekend.
Well.
I'll talk to you next week. All right, you too.
You
bye-bye.
Too. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. Two brilliant guys. Unfortunately, Brendan Beery, he had to leave a little bit early. And now Jeffrey Schwartz, who gave us a couple more minutes, which is really terrific. And now we're going to move on to our next guest, and we'll just make sure if it is Mr. Jaffe, because I can't tell who's on when they call. So is this Mr. Jaffe?
Yes, it is. Can you hear me?
How are you? Yes, we
I'm
can hear very you very
good.
Well.
That's
I'm thrilled.
Good,
I'm thrilled to be able to speak to you. And somebody else had dropped out, so it's just you and I at the moment. So first of all, what made you consider running for political office? I didn't realize that you'd be interested. You were in other fields in business, weren't you?
Yes. I've been successful and blessed. And looking at the turmoil, the high inflation, gas is $6 a gallon. My Con Ed bill is through the roof. Friends of mine that have infants can't get formula. And I'm a Ukrainian Jew, and our country is being attacked. Things aren't good, and we need leadership. I'm willing to step up and go to Washington and represent all the people of New York 16, which is your listeners, southern part of Westchester.
Absolutely. And what is it about our politicians? Are we not clear about the direction that they're going? Because we don't always have clarity in the voices of the people who want to represent us. How do you bring clarity and, you know, to the equation? How do you bring that forward?
It's interesting. Congress is a big hall. It has about 350 people in the House of Representatives from all 50 states based on population. Yeah. And then the U.S. Senate has two people from each state. It's just based on statehood. So every state gets a voice, but it's diluted. We have to convince the House to pass a bill, and then we have to convince the 100 senators to pass a bill, and that's how we make laws. That's how we decide whether we're going to war. That's how we decide a lot of things. The power of the purse, writing laws, and overseeing agencies that are empowered by Congress to make sure that New York gets its fair share of the money back. So I will be a strong voice. During one of my earlier interviews, somebody said, well, that can't possibly be, Mark, because no rookie congressperson ever gets to meet the big big macas, so to speak. And I said, listen, I'm no rookie. My opponents are probably more rookie than me. I know all these leaders, and believe me, they're going to listen to me because our approach at the chamber, our successes at the Greater New York Chamber, both helping small businesses and entrepreneurs and creating great civic communities and causes, speaks for itself.
Well, it does. So tell us a little bit more about the Greater New York Chamber, because that must give you access to a lot of powerful people with many varied interests that all impact our political demeanor over time. So you must have an unbelievable panoply of friends and associates and people who respect you, and I guess even others that don't, but it doesn't really matter. The point is that you know these people. You can call them up and say, hey, I got an issue here.
Is that something that we realize? I realize it. My members realize it, and now your listening audience will hear about it. One example, one of our members called up, and again, this goes to your Con Ed bill. Look at your Con Ed bill. Nobody's happy with it. I got a call pre-COVID from one of my members. He had signed a 10-year lease, and he had spent 9 months rebuilding his restaurant, building it out. When he was ready to open it, he called Con Ed, the National Grid, which is the Con Ed out in Brooklyn and Queens. We have members throughout the state and the tri-state area. And they kind of told him, well, don't you know there's a moratorium? We're not giving anybody new gas. So, of course, he called the chamber. We got all this paperwork. We did a brief for the governor's office. His public utilities regulators looked at it. We also met with Tish James about the issue. And 110 days later, National Grid was forced to pay a $36 million settlement to 1,000 people that were affected by the billion-dollar regulatory agency that thinks it's too big to really service the people. This is the type of service that I plan to go in and work with all the administrative agencies and make sure that we're getting the job done for the people of New York 16.
Well, it does seem, when you talk about the Public Service Commission, they seem to be running their own little operation, and they don't listen as much, nor are they, I guess, compliant with some of the issues that the consumer has to contend with, especially now when we're going through such financial travails all over the place on so many issues. Why is that? Is there a way of fixing the PSC?
I think that we need to put stronger people in there, put teeth in the regulations. People have asked me, how are you going to do that? I go, well, I'm an attorney. I'm going to Washington, D.C. as a lawmaker. We'll put the clauses in that punish people that take advantage of the hardworking class. We need to be effective. The Greater New York Chamber of Commerce is not funded by tax dollars. We don't have unlimited resources. Our membership supports us. And we get things done in a very efficient way. And we are the largest membership chamber of commerce here in Manhattan. We have members all over the county, the state, because people know we get it done. In addition to that, we provide many networking opportunities so businesses can meet one another. During COVID, we were able to switch to Zoom, and now we're coming back to in-person meetings right here in our building. We have the fourth floor of a landmark building right near Grand Central Station. So working with agencies, that's what I did as an attorney. They are given the powers by Congress to regulate certain industries, and sometimes they do a good job, and sometimes you got to wonder who was watching Similac. We had to shut down
they weren't.
Well, I mean, granted, we had to clean out those tanks, but Why did it take so long?
Well, because,
was this a multi-million?
Well, that's what I didn't understand. When they knew that the factory was infected and they could no longer produce, so why didn't they clean it up before the formula and the ingredients for the formula could be brought in? So they waited till the ingredients of the formula could be started to be mixed, and that's when they began to clean up, which probably forced another week or 10 days before the cleanup was done. Well, evidently there were no regulations that demanded it to be done differently.
Well,
so,
apparently the regulators weren't doing a good job. They were the ones that said, hey, there may be contamination. We need to shut it down. Where was the follow-up?
Uh-huh.
Why do we have
exactly.
a national shortage on infant formula? One theory might be that a multi-billion-dollar corporation that controls so much of the industry didn't
mm-hmm.
want to clean it up quickly because now there's a shortage, and they could then take popular will and turn that into, let's raise the prices for the next two decades. This is good for us. But it wasn't good for the
yeah.
families that had to worry about nutrition for their infants. Regulation, mm-hmm. common sense, and staying on top of these agencies is part of the job of a lawmaker in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely. When you look at the 16th Congressional District, what is it that you recognize to be a deficiency or not enough being focused on issues? What is it that you recognize is what the public in the 16th District is looking for? So what issues are you going to focus your attention on?
We need to really look at we have a very diverse district here, even just in
mm-hmm.
southern Westchester. So one of the
yes.
issues that's always been in the priority for me
mm-hmm.
is civility. I mean, we can't fight with people just
that's
because
true.
They're Republicans, because they right now can block important bills that are good for America. And it's not just Republicans. It's different factions of different parties. When we
mm-hmm.
were able to work with our country was able to work with 16 or 17 Republican senators to get them to endorse Biden's $1.2 trillion Infrastructure Act. I was interviewed on CNN because we're recognized as one of the top economic development agencies in the state, and
mm-hmm.
people want to hear what's going on. And I'll
yeah.
never forget when the CNN reporter sat back in his chair and said, how could this not pass with bipartisan support? I go, well, some people in the Democratic Party are going to play politics with $1.2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, $1.2 trillion, saying it's not
mm-hmm.
enough. And that's exactly what happened. And flooding was happening. We weren't getting that money. People hit their potholes. They paid for their rims. You can't play politics when we have money in hand. You get that money, and you negotiate for additional services. That's
well,
what happened.
I've got to ask you about that, Mr. Jaffe, because you're making a tremendous amount of sense. The only thing that I find deficient, and I could be inappropriately wrong because I'm not there in the august bodies where these things are discussed, so I don't really see the discourse that really takes place. And even when you've got great reporters, they aren't always privy to all the things that go on, and certainly not what's going on in the back room. How does one present all the salient issues on a particular legislation where you have people who are recalcitrant, who don't want to go in that direction because of their political perspective, whether it be to take advantage of being able to bring about a majority or playing some other game there? How do you make it so that the public really knows what's going on? And do we need to know all that? I think we do, because
well,
I think
we
a
should
lot of
be able to
stay ignorant.
We should be able to find it out. Most people don't want to know, don't care. We do have C-SPAN,
Why?
So you can watch the deliberations and the discussions and the expert witnesses in
uh-huh.
the body in Washington, D.C. But the real negotiations may happen at the gym when fellow politicians are working out together, fellow people in the House of Representatives are having a dinner together, committees, subcommittees. It's my job to represent the people of New York first and foremost. Obviously, we're all Americans when it comes to national war issues. And I can't believe that we didn't attempt harder to get NATO to put economic sanctions along with us on Russia pre-Olympics before they invaded Ukraine. I'm a Ukrainian Jew, and I think it's horrible what's happening in that country. And now we're in a war. We don't have boots on the ground, but we're spending hundreds of billions of dollars, and we should have sanctioned Russia before they invaded. To me, that would be common sense, and we would be talking about that. We'd be talking with NATO partners, and maybe we would have got it done. But nothing is certain when you're deliberating with 350 other people, and then it has to go to another 100 people. But that's the beauty of the body. We are deliberating. We are making moves. I hope to bring more civility and common sense. New York, everybody knows, pays its fair share of taxes. Your listeners know. We don't get the same nickels back. We don't get the same nickels back.
Well, a lot of people don't realize that. It's so interesting because they don't realize that places like California and New York, we still have two votes in the Senate like everybody else, but we pay more in taxes, and without New York taxes being paid and the success in New York or California and maybe a few other states, places like Florida are going to go belly up. And what about Texas? And what about so many other places? Do we understand all these dynamics?
We understand it. I understand it. I understand that I have to go out with people from Montana and Utah and Wyoming, where they have a disproportionate amount of power in the august body called the Senate, the United States Senate, 100 senators. And Chuck Schumer is the majority leader there, and he's a New Yorker. But he's going to need a strong voice, not somebody to just jump on any political issue that's good for the squad or toxic politics, issues that make bread and butter, that put money back in New York. We were able to accomplish that post 9/11. There was so much love for New York because we were attacked. People were in shock. We need to get that type of, and you said it very well, New York pays the bills. New York has the population. We're a model state. Right now, women's rights is at risk. I've been to many protests, heard many great and heartwarming stories. And there is no reason that the federal health agencies should not be knowing right now that we're going to need money because people are coming all over, traveling to New York, will be coming because we have model clinics here, abortion clinics, safe health procedures. And we need to be reimbursed because we put more money into the federal system in terms of taxes than most any other state.
Right. Somehow we don't get that message out very clearly. Does New York's prowess and I guess its exemplary direction from government, whether it be Republican or Democrat, I mean, each one had their bit that they added to the panache of a state like New York. But do people in New York recognize it, or is it that the other states don't recognize it because there's such a divide? And what are we doing wrong if we don't tell people what New York is doing and how it's accomplishing its goals and protecting people's rights?
It's complicated because, first of all, with the way the voting power is structured, the other states are selfish. If they can get more out than they put in, they don't believe in that equity, and they want to tell their constituents, look what we did. We got more money per head, per road in our state because some of those states are big, but less people are using the highways. They don't appreciate the fact that how much commerce and comes through New York, over our bridges, through our tunnels, our airports, our freight. And those agencies, we would bring expert testimony. We know the people, as you said, from the Port Authority. We know the dangers of not repairing our tunnel, the Gateway Project. We know how many Americans and how many dollars are generated and then sent back to these more rural states. We need to keep shouting it from the rooftops. And quite honestly, I'm sure that some of the more senior politicians know some of this, but as the president of the chamber for over two decades, I've lived it. I know what the agencies are doing. And I will not, as one of the reporters said, well, you'll just be a rookie. No, I'm not a rookie. I'm a very sage, polished attorney. I know this stuff. I put my record as the president of the chamber, hard accomplishments, some of them on our website, Jaffe, J-A-F-F-E, the number 4NY.com. But what we've accomplished is probably more than the three people I'm running against in a Democratic primary have done in actual legislation. One of them, you know, is only we sent him there 2 years ago, and what do we have? We're in a war. Infinite formula was hard to get. How terrible is that? Gas is approaching $6 a gallon. It's nobody's better off than they were 2 years ago. It's time to get somebody that's tough, New York tough, and New York smart. When you think of New York, you think of toughness. You think of the best. We're the Empire State. We have a lot of great institutions, educational institutions. I was privileged to go to Cardozo Law School, and you know, I was able to pass the bar. And here at the Chamber, we have a legal center to help small businesses, startups, and veterans, and anybody that's a member of the Chamber get their legal sorts in order. And then we have 70 attorneys that we work with, you know, if it becomes a complicated issue. Different people need different things. Some people, they're fighting their mom and pop business, but they want to get divorced. There are many issues that need to be worked out in law, and that's what Congress does. They deliberate, they meet, and I know some of these people from all over the country, certainly throughout the state. I know all the top elected officials, our Congress delegation, our senators, Kirsten Gillibrand, Chuck Schumer. It's not
you
like they don't know.
You got their numbers, and they have yours, so you you guys all know each other.
And
how,
more than that,
how do you bring these disparate concepts and people with different perspectives? How do you bring them together? Is there a way of inviting them, let's say, for to dinner, and everybody sits down, and rather than having a screaming match, they could find out what it is that they like about each other and how they can move the direction forward? For the
people,
you know, for the state, for people's rights, for people's protections, because a lot of people are deflated by what's happened at the Supreme Court, and they're afraid of even more ramifications. As the Supreme Court is, I never would have imagined the Supreme Court is the place where the revolution began, and it looks like they've thrown out everything.
Well,
people don't feel safe.
People don't feel safe. The guns and the decision on carrying, which is difficult because you do need interstate commerce. You do need and the woman's right to choose and abortion. With interstate commerce and the way we get around now, it's very complicated, and it's sad that that different people are going to be subject to different rules. If I mail order you know, birth control from Wyoming, or if I live in Wyoming and I mail order birth control from New York, am I violating a Wyoming law? I'm beginning to hear, because as you said, we listen to a lot of lawmakers and judges. We know everybody. I feel like sometimes I feel like I'm Don Corleone. We know all the judges. We know all the attorney generals, the district attorneys. We can vouch for people if they've made a slight mistake. But what's happening today, we're letting people make mistakes and keep making mistakes. We hear that violent crime is down, and those statistics are probably somewhat accurate, but nobody's talking about property crime. is not down.
No.
And this is very disturbing. Nobody wants their phone stolen. Oh, it's not a big deal. You didn't get hurt. Yes, it is a big deal if some criminal is stealing phones all the time and we know they have a rap sheet. We need to stop that behavior and protect people. And we can do that at the local level with additional resources to fund our police and add to their manpower or their staffs with people that are trained in mental health care. And everybody is always
that.
Who don't carry guns. That will be costly, but worth it, because that's what the people want. And we hear them marching in the streets for that. But there's something, and I'm sure your listeners saw the movie with Al Pacino, Serpico. If you want to get rid of the few bad cops that we have, I'm sure, in every state, in every precinct house, all those police, all those public safety officials, there is somebody, very small percentage, just like in school or any place. There's maybe a bad apple. Let's invoke a Serpico type of law where anybody that rats out on good cause a bad cop is going to get a big bonus. There will be no bad cops in those precinct houses if we give that type of incentive.
So that's a brilliant concept, but it's never been tried. Is there a reluctance to say it the way it needs to be done and the way it can be done and the way it can be ameliorated? Is that the problem? Because there seems
Part
to be a timidity in the political realm where we don't have clarity, we don't have succinctness in thinking and in explaining what the issues are. It seems that we have a different vocabulary among so many in politics, whereas there are some others that are extremely fluent. And I would prefer an exact attitude and an explanation, a validity to a particular perspective. Why don't we get that? Why is it so difficult?
Part of it is politics. You got to go along to get along. We all got to vote lockstep together. This is the bigger goal. And a lot of people get run over in that. The other big part of that is the eloquence. Depending on the political person, they don't have the skills, the oratory or the rhetoric or the can't explain their point, can't back up their point. Those types of issues, I'm so excited with the possibility of being able to serve in Congress, because people will know not only what I'm saying, but it will be backed up by good, solid fundamentals, research, and facts. And they will hear.
Actually, I have to applaud that, because even though I don't know you very well, and it's the first time we've ever spoken, other than just to, you know, make sure that you'd be able to get onto the broadcast, I applaud you for your capacity to give expression to ideas, which I don't always hear. And I think that's very, very, very salient and important, because I think a lot of the public that it needs to know, they don't know. I don't know why they don't know. I don't know how
they should know more.
Better. Yeah,
they should know more. And, you know, we have Bruce Springsteen wrote a song many years ago when I was in college. And I think it was 100 channels and nothing's on. You know, he's kind of making fun of, you know, the television, radio stations, whatever. And I like to joke now, there's closer to 3,000 stations and everything's on. So how do you filter and process all that? A lot of it is done, you know, through our public education system, making sure that our kids are taught the fundamentals, not so much, you know, family values in school, but the fundamentals so they can get a job. And then when they go... graduate from public school, high school, they should be encouraged not to just rush into a four-year commitment to go to any college and get a degree that will not lead to a job. And we actually have a plan where people can earn while they learn. We're doing that now. Yes. We hire local college kids and we give them jobs here at the chamber in our business center for 12 hours while they're working at school. It helps put them through school, but they're learning slowly. So they don't just jump into a major. They're learning what they like to do in life. And those schools, whether it's a trade school, a community college, 2 years, a nursing school, or the whole, you know, becoming a lawyer or a doctor. If they give you a degree, we should regulate those schools more. We've heard the horror stories of people being in debt. But if we regulate those schools that they give these students, these graduates, these people that they're vouching for and have graduated, if we give them the degree, they better find them a job or they're going to be liable through that money that we collect will be invested to pay the interest on the deferment on their loans until that school gets them a job commensurate with the skills that they were promised. That will solve the student loan crisis. Yeah. And politicians are lying now. We're going to rip up the debt. We're going to rip up the debt.
Legal remedy. Yeah, exactly.
Well,
it's
a regulatory power. Anybody that's and it's here now. Right? Any institution is regulated. The biggest news story was Donald Trump's schools were attacked by the attorney generals because they felt that there was no valuable skill.
Amazing.
For the,
before
a lot of schools
Donald
are
Trump,
doing that.
We'll have to say for another time. How do people get in touch with your campaign? You've got a website address that people can go to?
Yes, Jaffe, J-A-F-F-E, the number 4, N-Y, Jaffe4NY.com. And you can reach out to me. My email is Mark, M-A-R-K, at Jaffe4NY.com. And, you know, we also have a campaign office number. We have two, 914-730-2660 and also 914-242-6237. And you can text that number and somebody will get right back to you. I'm running to be a congressman for New York. I'm going to make sure that not only do we get our salt back, but that other people in Washington know how much bacon we supply to Washington, and we just want our fair share back.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, Mr. Jaffe, you were giving expression to your thought, and we got disconnected from the radio. We had three problems today. I don't know why. It's very unusual. Would you mind repeating that? Because I don't think that went on the air.
You're talking about repeating
your
my address
thought.
Or my...
Oh, yeah, no, you're talking about your campaign effort.
Yes.
You know, how do people get in touch with you and learn the positions that you've taken already? And that
sure.
You
well,
may be
my positions are evolving because I'm listening to the people of New York 16. And if they send me to Washington, D.C., I'll be a strong voice to let everybody in the country know not only do we want our salt back, so to speak, because Trump took away those tax deductions for the hardworking middle-class families. They will know how much bacon we have in the game. We supply more to the federal government than we get back. And if you want somebody that's going to be able to wine and dine and talk to legislators from all across the country, Montana, Utah, the people skills, I went to MBA school out in that part of the country. I was able to succeed out there creating a business. These are people that need to know that New York is helping them, and we need to move the dial forward. And if you want me to speak for you, feel free to go to my website, send me an email. That's Jaffe, J-A-F-F-E, the number 4NY.com, or email me directly, Mark, M-A-R-K, at Jaffe4NY.com, or just call me at or text me at 914-242-6237.
Well, I want to thank you for making the time for our listeners and certainly for making the time for me. I really appreciate your making the time because not everybody can or does, and you got a full schedule, so I appreciate it. Hopefully you'll come back because when are the are people already involved in the election process?
Well, right now, today's a big day. I hope everybody in your audience has
voted
early, which is great.
Today. I'm going to
you know, we all want to make sure people can vote, and we've come such a long way where people can just, you know, vote 2 weeks before the election. Makes it convenient for those that can't get the day off to vote. And we're still going to have a low voter turnout because this is just gubernatorial and, you know, some of the state seats. And the politicians have created another primary, which will be August 23rd. So we're respectfully involved in a campaign, but it's going to be a short cycle because we're going to know the results of today's primary, and then we're going full throttle because some of our staff has been helping, you know, the governor and the lieutenant governor take care of business. We have a great state.
Excellent.
Send me to Washington, and everybody will know, and I will make it better.
Okay.
Give it my
Mark
best.
Mark Staffy, from your words to God's ears. That's
thank
perfect.
You, Hezzy. Thank you for
best.
Taking the time, and we appreciate what
time.
You do.
My pleasure. Thank you. Take care. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Well, there we have it, folks. Mark Jaffe. He's running for the New York State Congressional District 16, and you can even cast your vote today. I know I'm going to cast my vote today, and so that's going to be really very interesting. Well, let's see. We're going to move on to some other issues at the moment. We're going to move on to a couple of things. Bear with me. I want to first do some domestic things that are going on. So, this is really interesting, actually. It's apropos to what we were talking to Lamar Katz about. And one of the people that is very, very kind to us, he usually writes a column once a week. He's based out of Switzerland, out of Zurich. So he says there are three things to do at the end of an election campaign. So that's where we're approaching. And so he writes, if you're entering the home stretch of an election campaign and the race is close, he says, I suggest you hit your opponent harder. And this doesn't mean to be nasty. Depending on the cultural context, this can be done elegantly and maybe even implicitly. The key is to draw the lines of distinction clearer, because the bottom line is this: you can't win a close race on the defense. Two, if you are ahead, double down on what's working. Nervous candidates sometimes react too much to what their opponents do. Instead, listen and react to the voters. If research shows that you're at it converting votes, air more of it. Three, lastly, and either way, you have to turn out the base. In a local election, physical presence is key just for that. And in every election, there are votes left on the table. And Dr. Louis Perron says, I wrote about this in one of my previous updates. There is no king without a kingdom. And you therefore have to maximize the votes of the kingdom, which can be geographically defined area, a socio-demographic part of the electorate, or a pressure group or organization supporting your candidacy. So for heaven's sake, he says, spend the money you have in the bank. Don't spend more. However, as raising money for a past campaign is a big headache. So Dr. Louis Perron is an internationally renowned expert in winning elections, and during the past years, he's won dozens of election and referendum campaigns in various countries. He's fluent in German and French and English, just a brilliant, brilliant man, and it's so good to be able to have him as one of our writers because he shares his thinking. And his thinking is like, it's like a layer of complexity that you can place in any country around the world, because he's able to somehow decipher the logistics and the requirements of campaigning. And there is no difference in how you campaign in one country or one district than another. So very, very important stuff. So I hope you can appreciate that. And we've got many articles from him. He literally writes about once a week. So that's important. And let me just quickly look here. There were other things I wanted to share with you. One second here. Oh, yeah, in case you haven't heard this, there's going to be a weekend closure of the Hutchinson River Parkway expected between Exit 4A and Exit 8 in Westchester County. That's from 12 a.m. on Saturday, July 10th, so you got time to plan it out, to 5 a.m. on Monday, July 11th in both directions. So that's important just in case you're a commuter. That's really important. And let me just think here. What else do we have here? Where are we? Okay, I think that we've really covered most of that. All right, so now what I want to do is, oh, yeah, there is something really interesting that you might find interesting. The Westchester County COVID-19 dashboard. We hadn't received it before, but Westchester County's county executive, George Latimer, his department has now afforded us the opportunity to show you a map of the county and those people that are infected with COVID and so on and so forth, and those that have come down with the infection and so on, and those that aren't. So very important stuff if you want to know what's really going on. And so that's very compelling. And then let's move on then to the international front. Bear with me a second. Okay. And we'll cover a couple of things that are really pertinent. We only have 20 some odd minutes. Now, where is it here? This is really very interesting. It seems that the G7 leaders have pledged an unwavering support for the Ukraine. So, and that's really just like unbelievable because that's very, very important. So, one second here. Yeah. One second here. See, I've got to get to some of my notes. There's so much that's on all over the place. We're a minute here. This is the latest thing. The G7 summit. Evidently, the leaders have explored the Russian oil price cap. So the G7 leaders are examining a new package of actions aimed at increasing pressure on Russia over its war in Ukraine. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky appeared by video to appeal for more help. So U.S. and French officials confirmed that the leaders of the G7 summit had made progress on Monday on setting a price cap on Russian oil imports to curb Moscow's energy revenue. So news of plans for ramped-up sanctions affecting oil and Russia's military machine emerged as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed the summit by video link. So the dual objective of the G7 leaders have been to take direct aim at Russian President Vladimir Putin's revenues, particularly through energy, but also to minimize the spillovers and the impact on the G7 economies in the rest of the world. Reuters news agency reported that an official is saying that on the sidelines of the summit. So as the summit talks got underway, the United States also said that sanctions would target Russia's defense industry in a bid to hamper the effectiveness of the Russian military. So Zelensky appeared on a television screen next to leaders' round table at the secluded Schloss Elmau luxury hotel in Germany. He asked the group for anti-aircraft defense systems, security guarantees, help on grain exports, further sanctions on Russia, and reconstruction aid, according to European officials. So that's what's really going on. So very, very compelling stuff. It looks like we're at that point where the war has been going on for over 3 months. And it is absolutely mind-boggling how the Ukrainians have held on to the territory that they have with no ammunition, no artillery. They have just, and their wheat and their other stockpiles of food are being stolen by the Russians. And it just goes on and on and on. the audacity of the Russians to do what they're doing is just unbelievable. It is literally amazing that they've gotten away with so much. Okay, so let's move on to some different slots here. Bear with me a moment so I go to my other notes, and we'll see where we go here. One second. All right, one second here. This is really very interesting because evidently a synagogue is suing Florida over the abortion limits, a possible template for future challenges. It seems that a lawsuit was brought by a Florida synagogue which claims reducing access to abortion is not compatible with Jewish law and making it a violation of the constitutional right to freedom of religious expression. In the wake of the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, does the lawsuit offer a template for other legal challenges, which is a real question? A lawsuit filed on June 10 by a synagogue in Florida has challenged plans to limit abortions in the state on the ground that it would violate religious rights and therefore be unconstitutional. So the Jewish faith holds the right to an abortion to be inviolable. So the Florida bill is set to lower the maximum threshold for abortions from 24 weeks down to 15 weeks from July 1, with exceptions in instances where the medical procedure could save the life or prevent serious injury to the mother. So it offers no exceptions for victims of incest, rape, or human trafficking. But these restrictions would infringe upon Jewish women's right to abortions as guaranteed by their faith and are thus incompatible with the Florida Constitution's right to privacy and religious freedom, so says the lawsuit, which was brought by Rabbi Barry Silver on behalf of the roughly 150 members of the congregation Le Dor Vador in Palm Beach County. So if a fetus poses a threat to the health or emotional well-being of its mother at any stage of gestation up until birth, Jewish law does not entitle, and not only entitles, but requires the mother to abort the pregnancy and protect herself, the suit argues. So what's the only alternative? The suit was filed in advance of a long-expected ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court, which on Friday struck down the 1973 law that legalized abortion nationwide. So as the court overturned the Roe v. Wade ruling, it increased individual states' powers to enforce their own abortion laws, with 26 conservative states now expected to introduce restrictions or outright bans on the procedure. In Florida, for example, Governor Ron DeSantis quickly promised more restrictions to expand, quote, pro-life protections, end quote, in the wake of the ruling, in addition to those already set to come into effect in July 1. Well, while some have celebrated the Supreme Court's decision, others have bitterly opposed it. So the U.S. National Women's Law Center described it as an extremist attack on women's rights. The U.S. President Joe Biden, his administration will do all it can to protect remaining abortion rights. However, reversing the court's decision would be practically impossible. According to Emma Long, Associate Professor of American History and Politics at the University of East Anglia in the United Kingdom, there are only two ways to rescind a Supreme Court decision. The first is to convince the court to overturn its own decision, something it has rarely done, which makes the decision to overturn Roe v. Wade extremely unusual. The second is an amendment to the U.S. Constitution itself, which has only happened 17 times since 1791, and as Long said, quote, particularly on an issue this divisive, it's just not going to happen, end quote. A single lawsuit brought in Florida against the state's constitution rather than the U.S. Constitution might thus seem like feeble resistance, but it draws on deep-rooted legal precedents. Freedom of religious expression is a First Amendment right. Meanwhile, there is no mention of abortion in the Constitution, meaning the constitutional laws around the practice are always interpretative. So citing such an inalienable right as religion establishes the suit on, quote, stronger legal ground than trying to push for the creation of new laws to re-legalize abortion, Long had said. So bringing a constitutional case is literally the only option, but it's also a very clever legal move. So it's a question of religion. Now, broadly speaking, Jewish law stipulates that life begins at birth and that until that point, the mother's life is prioritized. So in order to protect the health of the pregnant person, abortion is permissible and sometimes mandated, said Samira Mehta. She's an associate professor of women and gender as well as Jewish studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. The definition of what counts as a health threat varies between Jewish communities, with the congregation of Lador Vador in Florida at the liberal end of the spectrum. But Mehta had said there is agreement on the principle that abortion is a right, quote, and that is a religious matter, not a decision for this. Aha, and that's your premise. Traditionally, U.S. courts have been sympathetic to legal arguments made on similar constitutional grounds. Historically, minority religious groups have benefited from rulings that protected traditions not accounted for in general law. For example, a 1996 ruling allowed the use of the banned substance peyote, I don't know how you exactly pronounce it, exclusively in Native American religious ceremonies. More recently, the balance of power has changed. Quote, in the last 15 years or so, the Supreme Court has used religious freedom language to protect the rights of majority religious groups, particularly white evangelical Christians, Long had said. It has led to cases that question the concept of who is a majority and who is a minority, such as those against legalizing gay marriage on the grounds it discriminates against the groups who do not support marriage rights for all. So while those cases were dismissed, others, namely around religion in schools, have been passed. So in the national discussion around rolling back abortion rights, the National Council of Jewish Women said on its website that the conversation was so dominated by the Christian right that it had ignored Jewish votes or Jewish voices in Florida. The Lador Vador lawsuit says that new laws amount to, quote, imposing the laws of other religions upon Jews, end quote. So what we are seeing is a very powerful minority of conservative Protestant Catholic Americans dictating something that conflicts with other people's deeply held religious beliefs, Mehta had said, but religious freedom is something that is enshrined in American law for all Americans. So what happens when people's rights bump up against each other? Well, not much else to lose. Evidently, the Lador Vador lawsuit challenges the state's constitution, meaning a win would only have legal implications within Florida. But success would pave the way for similar lawsuits in other states. It could also set the stage for other suits claiming First Amendment violations that could have national implications. There is a potential in an argument that says the theological teachings prioritize the person who is pregnant, Long had said. To be legally successful, it would have to be framed very carefully, which is what conservatives have long been doing very successfully to achieve their policy aims for several decades now. So in fact, part of the uniqueness of the Florida suit is that it is a rare example of liberals using tactics normally deployed by conservatives to try to sway the courts towards their own values. And this is certainly a different angle, and it's really clever, given the way the court has been thinking about issues of religious liberty in the last decade and a half, Long had said. So nonetheless, even though the Florida suit contains, quote, an argument that should be taken seriously, end quote, Mehta says it is anyone's guess what the outcome might be. And most probable is that there will be no quick or easy victories for those fighting to regain abortion rights. Instead, they are likely to face legal obstacles, state-by-state battles, and bitter divisions on either side. Quote, it's a deeply polarized environment, end quote, Mehta said, adding that Jewish activists are also facing rising rates of anti-Semitism, and the price of failure in Florida may be high.
A loss would give other courts grounds to rule against similar cases and could feel like another nail in the coffin for reproductive rights in the United States. So it's a high stakes in, it's high stakes in some ways, said Long, but you could argue that given that Roe v. Wade has now gone, there's not much else to lose by trying. And that's really, really pertinent. Okay, so let's just quickly see. We have only a little bit more time, so maybe we'll be able to cover something else for you. Bear with me a moment. One second here. Yeah, I wanted to tell you about this, too. The Black Sea's Snake Island is emerging as crucial in the Russia-Ukraine war. You may or may not have heard about it. Snake Island is a tiny piece of land in the Black Sea near the Ukrainian port city of Odessa and has taken on symbolic importance for both sides in the conflict. Ukraine said last week that it had won a major military victory on the island, an account that Moscow disputes. The authorities in Kyiv said that Ukrainian forces had launched missile strikes and drones from the coast on June 21, destroying Russian military vehicles, anti-aircraft defenses, and a radar system on Snake Island, a piece of rock smaller than 0.7 square kilometers located about 40 kilometers southwest of Odessa. Well, the Russian military denied the claims, saying its defenses held up as its forces on the island intercepted all the Ukrainian missiles and shot down 13 of the 15 drones. Well, this ferocious contestation of the narrative says a lot about how important Snake Island is to both Kyiv and Moscow. While it is difficult to discern where the truth lies, it is certain that, quote, Ukrainian missiles did indeed hit military targets, end quote, on the island, according to SimTak, S-I-M, and then his last name, Tak, T-A-C-K, an analyst at the U.S. military consultancy Force Analysis. Well, Tak studied satellite images of Snake Island after the offensive. Quote, we can see the impact of the bombing, end quote, he said. We can also see the Russian Pantsir, P-A-N-T-S-I-R, anti-aircraft missiles, or rather vehicles that were supposedly destroyed, although it's difficult to see whether or not they're still operational, end quote. So it was not the first time Ukraine has targeted Russian positions around the island. On June 17, Kyiv claimed it had sunk a tugboat transporting munitions to Russian troops. This came after the Ukraine launched several offensives in May trying to recapture Snake Island, and in response, the Russian military reinforced its presence there. Well, it's a battle cry for Ukrainians. Nevertheless, some analysts raised their eyebrows at the fighting over Snake Island. It has very limited strategic importance in terms of who controls the Black Sea, said Jeff Horn, an expert on Russian military issues and a non-resident fellow at the New Lines Institute, a U.S. geopolitical research center. Snake Island's most significant quality is its proximity to Odessa. It has often been described as a gateway to Ukraine's preeminent port. In theory, whoever controls this piece of land also controls access to Odessa. And Snake Island could thus be vital to preventing a full-blown global food crisis, given that Ukraine once exported some 4.5 million tons of food per month through Odessa before the port was blockaded by Russia. So Batak suggested that Snake Island's strategic value is overestimated in this regard. The military equipment stationed there is essentially defensive and has a very limited range, he said. Snake Island first came to prominence in the first days of the Russian invasion with reports that the Russian warship Moskva had demanded Ukrainian soldiers on the island surrender. Well, Russian warship, go fuck yourself, came the reply, which quickly became a pro-Ukrainian slogan. Good for them. Well, Snake Island has become a kind of battle cry for Ukrainians who see it as a symbol of their resistance to an enemy most people thought was stronger than them, Horn had said. Now, taking back Snake Island would therefore be a major propaganda coup for Ukraine. It would suggest to many that Kyiv had reversed the war's tide in its favor. Moscow is all too aware of this, and so the Russians will do everything they can to hold on to it, Horn said.
Snake Island has thus become a poisonous prize for Russia. Moscow seized it because it was, quote, part of the battle for control of the Black Sea, end quote, as TAC put it. However, Russia did not expect to have to devote so many resources to defending such a tiny piece of land. The problem is that it's very difficult to keep this island properly supplied because any boat that goes there is within range of Ukrainian rocket launchers, TAC had noted, and these are resources that Russia must divert from the war's other theaters, most prominently the Donbas. Well, Snake Island has more than just symbolic value, and the sinking in late April of the Moskva, which was the flagship of Russia's Black Sea fleet, Snake Island can also be seen as a static warship that cannot be sunk, said Horn. Like a warship, Snake Island provides an observation post from which to detect enemy movements in the area and can be used to bombard passing ships and planes. Ukraine must also keep an eye out to ensure that Russia does not launch an amphibious assault using Snake Island as an outpost. The international community sees Snake Island as a well-defined target for Ukrainian artillery, so by striking it over and over again, Kyiv is showing that its army can challenge Russian supremacy in the Black Sea. That's according to Horn. So that's the reality. And let's go back to our studio screen. So we've only got about 2 minutes left. Let me just quickly see what's on for tomorrow. I don't remember what we have scheduled for you tomorrow. Bear with me as I look at my calendar. So much stuff, I don't even know what the hell is going on. Oh, tomorrow's the 29th. Oh, this is going to be terrific. We're going to be speaking to Oren M. Levin-Waldman. He's a socioeconomic research scholar. He'll be on with us from 10 to 11 o'clock in the morning. You'll be able to read his dissertation or his essay sometime today on the website. And then at 11 o'clock, we're going to speak to Max McAuliffe, who is professed to be gay. And we'll talk to him about politics. And the last half hour will just be with you and I. So that's the story. And then we got great stuff on Thursday with Brian Harrod from Yonkers Newswire and the Driving Me Crazy duo. They're going to give a new review of an automotive review. And that'll be it. So, and then I don't even remember, I don't have time to tell you what's going on Friday, but we'll find out what's Friday later on. So that's the end of our day with you. Have a great day. Thanks for being with us. And we'll speak to you tomorrow with Professor Oren M. Levin-Waldman. Goodbye.